These inform me he has a knife and he will wield it if I go over 20 minutes. But he's also told me that I have to provide solutions, so I don't know how to do that in 20 minutes, but we'll try. I think my task is to talk out of the sort of Burke, Tocqueville, Nisbet tradition, and I hope to be faithful to that. I want to talk about social justice, community, and the dangers of abstraction. And I'll make a few basic claims before I go to the text that I hope will help frame in, what I have to say later. I make these claims. The contemporary progressive project is to atomize and then reincorporate. Progressives seek to weaken society, by which I mean intermediate institutions, and to leave individuals alone, weak, and alienated, and then offer them a new community of purpose. Our real battle is therefore not between individualism and community, but between two competing kinds of community. Now, one of the questions that I have is how did these ideas become sufficiently attractive to have the kind of political success? And I think there's a history to this that we might want to pay more attention to than we have time here. In the 80s and 90s, progressives or liberals offered an attractive communitarian critique to American individualism. But they did so adopting a kind of conservative language, but hiding the fact that it was essentially a statist enterprise. It was a whole different construction of community. But they grabbed a hold of this word, this concept, in light of a society that experienced some levels of alienation. And social justice served as the primary moral vision in support of this new statist community. By offering a radically abstract egalitarian vision of justice, social justice did the intellectual work of alienating people from their diverse and tradition-bound and sometimes subtly hierarchical social institutions, and thus prepared them to be reincorporated as equal and alike atoms in a national community. Conservatives are not to blame for this, but they have to accept some responsibility for making the appeals of national community and social justice acceptable to Americans. Conservatives have, by and large, since the 70s and early 80s, adopted too abstract a political vocabulary and have not provided a sufficiently robust and powerful defense for civil society. Russell Kirk and Robert Nisbet and others of this tradition have largely fallen out of favor, even though they provide the best intellectual and moral resources to engage the advocates of progressive community and social justice. The task ahead, therefore, requires a dedication to the philosophical, theoretical, and historical enterprise of supplying this defense for intermediate institutions as a necessary condition for the preservation of American liberty. At the same time we do that, this is a much more difficult one to persuade you on, I think, we need to cultivate a differentiated vocabulary that allows us to make fine distinctions rather than being bound to simplistic and abstract moral vocabulary. So those are the claims I hope to make. We ought to remember that in America, real power is vested in public opinion. Its power is monistic and is capable of great tyranny. When all are equal and no institution has the right to rule except by consent, then the question of rightness or goodness of a belief is a matter of numbers. Egalitarian democracy accepts tacitly that wisdom is better found in the many than the few or the one. We should take note here that it matters a great deal when we consider the size of the public that is empowered in this way. The larger the public, the less citizens are able to engage in anything approaching deliberation. The smaller the public, the more individual influences still play a role, as do reputation, bonds of memory, and a number of idiosyncratic factors that are tied to the particularity of that place. Public opinion is tolerant insofar as a vigorous majority has not formed an opinion on the subject. Such circumstances allows for serious debate and for individuals and groups to pronounce their views, including minority views, without public opprobrium. In these rare cases where moral beliefs are at stake and the majority in favor of one view is sufficiently invested in one answer to a moral question, real debate is difficult or perhaps even impossible. Often, changes in the approved moral visions happen very quickly, within a decade or so. The larger the public, the more prone it is to reverse its moral judgments. So, to the degree that we accept that public opinion serves as the final authority in America, how can we prevent it from becoming tyrannical? Tocqueville noted that several factors contributed to allowing American devotion to equality, and hence the power of public opinion, from destroying our liberty. First, the deep involvement of citizens in local rule created both deep commitments and affection among the citizens of each community for the ways that they do things. This emotional investment in the freedom of the community to govern itself came with a corollary. It required that people be functionally tolerant of other towns that differed from them. This, what I call distributive freedom of communities to govern themselves, also created a diverse patchwork of communities, and thus the whole system taken together contributed to a shared commitment to pluralism of this sort. Second, according to Tocqueville, a widespread culture of localist rule makes it very difficult for a national consensus on complex issues to develop with sufficient numbers and fervor. You have to have both. Liberty is maintained so long as the majority is not fervent. In the America of the 1830s, the vast number of local, partisan, and non-journalistic newspapers circulated opinions from all over the nation, but rarely lined up overwhelmingly on one side of a controversial issue. But when those institutions did line up, public opinion would be so clearly expressed and supported that disagreement was politically useless. The key to defending liberty in the context of popular sovereignty is therefore to create pluralism and affection for things particular, local, and small scale. The kind of community, the nature of the public to which a person most clearly belongs, shapes a person's moral reasoning. Attachment to custom and tradition is much easier for people who belong to communities with robust local rule, strong and semi-autonomous intermediate institutions, and a vivid historical memory. People of these kinds of communities are more invested in what is theirs particularly than what is claimed about humankind universally. In such context, they cultivate a vocabulary rich with contextual meanings and with modifiers implied or explicit. They will still defend in America equality, but they do so with a stock of meanings drawn from their own experiences of self-rule and passed down traditions. Such people live in those kinds of communities, are not likely to accept any veil of ignorance as a means of discerning moral truths, because the texture of their lives in community with others makes them accept context as being too important to exclude from moral deliberations. So, why are we now faced with a national public that is attentive to, even attracted to, the moral claims of social justice? Our moral reasoning reflects, I believe, high levels of alienation. In relative terms, we are disconnected from place. We have few attachments to institutions, particularly institutions that call us to purposes beyond those of the individual members. We accept the abstract individual as the primary moral agent, and we operate with a political and moral vocabulary that supplies clarity, undue clarity, because it's unencumbered with any contextual attachment which are not visible to the common sense of the atomized individual. The moral reasoner of our time is more often someone whose attachment to family is provisional, who lacks a developed historical imagination, who knows little about the places he lives, and whose involvements in churches and other institutions is a matter of temporary choice rather than primary obligation. For people such as this, the horizons are as small as their self-interest, but their moral proclamations are as broad as humankind. They think and speak in historical absolutes, usually about the rights of individuals to be free from all manner of entangling attachments. But as Robert Nisbet famously pointed out, their need for community for membership, for attachment, for status has not gone away. The progressive appeal to community beginning in the 1980s was very much a response to this human need in the context of that alienation. They rightly pointed out that many people felt disconnected and that the individualism of modern liberal capitalism didn't adequately serve by itself the spiritual and moral needs of the citizens. It is most important to note that the more politically savvy progressives of our time have semantically destroyed society as a meaningful category outside of the government. When, for instance, Hillary Clinton declared, this is I think in 93, that we should judge a society by how well it takes care of its most vulnerable members, she considered that all real responses to the social needs must be governmental. It takes a village only insofar as a village is defined as government. Clinton's construction would, over time, become more and more persuasive because what social institutions we still have are weak and they are ultimately answerable to governments of one sort or another. We could talk here about the relative health of institutions like family or churches or lodges, but the point is that by the time that the current administration came to power, a great many people thought in deeply individualistic terms and deployed a moral language that reinforced this kind of individualism. Emphasis upon this kind. Individualism does not lead to less government, but to less society and more government. Progressivism depends ultimately on individuals feeling that they should think of the federal government as their primary non-personal attachment. Nothing better identifies the potential triumph of government as community than the spreading appeal of social justice. The twin pillars of social justice, which I take to be equality and solidarity, depend upon a Rousseau-inspired process of atomizing and reincorporating. What I call atomizing, Rousseau and his followers would call liberation or emancipation, freedom. The Rousseauian progressive accepts that a person who is encased in traditions and social, religious, and familial institutions can only be authentic and free when those institutions can no longer define her or require of her any non-chosen fidelity or loyalty or obligation. To so liberate her, the state can't just provide a means of exit or to limit the coercive power of those institutions. It must go well beyond that. A person is only liberated when such institutions cannot appeal to her, when they are alien to her life and her purposes. So, for instance, a true progressive cannot abide homeschooling because it works directly against this liberation. In fact, to be a consistent progressive would have to advocate very early government intervention in a child's life so as to ensure equal treatment and to prevent too much influence from the family. The Rousseauian progressive project requires permanent revolution, since particular influences and various forms of social hierarchy constantly emerge. Every kind of difference becomes a source for real and potential inequality, and the least requires government vigilance. Citizens raised with the ideals of social justice, so cultivated, reared in this milieu, citizens become sensitive to all forms of inequality and therefore habituated to an ongoing moral enterprise of producing greater justice through greater equality. In this way, the human need for solidarity, for membership, and for some devotion to a moral purpose is satisfied, after a fashion, in the government's ongoing war against intermediate institutions. The progressive invocation of we is an excellent example of the process of atomization and reincorporation. The we is invariably an expression of solidarity that rests on beliefs about our essential quality and sameness, while giving to the government the role of expressing the solidarity made possible by projects that define our collective and moral purpose. In other words, the we expresses the ideal of a national community made up of equal people who have little connection with social institutions. The Life of Julia, which I assume all of you have seen, which at an earlier time would have stunned, But it expresses better than any other example that I know of the progressive identification of community, government, and social justice. The character Julie is remarkably without people or any institutions that are not directly a product of the government. This ad in support of Obama's agenda expressed it vividly, the banal character of life in the progressive state-run community, where each individual is equal, alike, and ultimately dehumanized. The rising acceptance of progressive conceptions of community and social justice comes in tandem with a conservative failure to defend and provide the necessary support to the social institutions that connect people in a meaningful to a meaningful history, to a shared and ongoing participation in cultural purpose, and provide people with a clear sense of membership. To put it differently, the appeal of social justice is only possible when people are alienated and when they think and talk in abstract categories, particularly moral categories. Properly understood, it has been the great conservative task in the American context to blunt the strong tendency toward abstraction, language, and thought, toward individualism and its partner, centralization. In its place, conservatives ought to do, I think, five things. One, remind people they belong to a story that extends both directions from their lives, past and the future. Two, support the idea of local government and push decision-making to as local level as possible, to invest people in their native country, as Tocqueville called it, to invest them in the choices that they make that create a distinctive, particular expression of social life. Three, defend the power, liberty, and functionality of civil institutions, especially family and religious institutions, against the reach of government. Four, navigate carefully the need to defend national or universal moral claims, which they have to be. There has to be some defense of universal moral claims. You can't escape that. The goal is to navigate that need against the importance of rooted local deliberation about the moral claims that require governmental action. This is the part I'm most intrigued by. To what degree is our moral understanding a product of how we live our daily lives? To what degree should our moral claims be an expression of lived experience, of the kind of relationship we have with our family, our churches, with our neighbors, that then percolate up to statements about universal moral principles, as opposed to the other way around? And five, fight an unending battle against the tendency to employ an ever more abstract political and moral vocabulary. In short, we are called to recover conservatism from a generation that knows only progressivism and right-wing liberalism. Thank you.